Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning, and welcome back to Masonic Home Companion. It's an absolute pleasure to have you here again. I hope you enjoy the program this fine day. Here we are on the 141st day of the year, 20th of May, 6012 Anno Lucas. I hope you've been doing well. It's been an exceptional week, both Masonically and socially, and the weather's been just very generous to us. I know you're all getting very excited, as you should be, the upcoming festivities for summer solstice. That's happening on the 20th of June this year, so mark your calendars. I'll see you all out at the 2309. That's 9 minutes after 11 at night. Feeling that great balance. You know, the solstice, it's important to, it's been important to our ancient ancestors, and we seem to have somehow lost track that it was fundamental in the development of faiths and beliefs that even have traces into the current time. It's that moment when the axial tilt of a planet's semi-axis is in a given hemisphere is inclined toward the star that it orbits. This is different than saying relating Earth and Sun. We could only blame ourselves for educating over the years and sending our scientists out to look at the far reaches of the universe. We only have ourselves to blame to begin to consider that there are other universes and there's other suns as big as our, there's other stars as big as our sun. And what can we say? There may be this possibility, but that's what the summer solstice is. Solstice could exist in other places. So, of course, the summer solstice occurs in the summer. The sun reaches its longest, highest position in the sky on the day of that. And that seems to be the balance, of course, between the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn. So, anyway, if you are doing well, I'm pleased to hear it. If you're not, I'll encourage you. We're going to be talking to a little bit about again, this notion of history and the importance of it. And I found an interesting quote from an interesting Greek philosopher, of course, Thucydides. And I know you'll all be, he was a Greek historian and an author. And he wrote a really interesting piece in the Peloponnesian War. Now, he existed somewhere between 460 BC and 395 BC. Very, very old fella. What he shared with us was a sense that sense of the perspective of us in the world. He has tied history into a very interesting, perhaps an idea that many of you shared. He says to us, history is philosophy, teaching by examples. History is philosophy, teaching by examples. We are brought to the threshold as Freemasons of the study of history. But you know that we always wrestle with this question about whether we all should be very much better schooled in history than we are. And I guess we could say, that's like saying to us, could each and every day, could we all do better? Well, yeah, that's a mother's milk kind of a statement. But I think this has a bit more of a bearing for some of us. History is philosophy teaching by examples. He also reminds us that few things are brought to a successful issue by impetus desire, but most by calm and prudent forethought. So please give this an opportunity to percolate through. He is saying something that has some merit. But you know, if you're like our other friend that I've often quoted, I have no special talent. I am only passionately curious. That's a quote from our friend Al. Left us so much relativity and things like that. So the idea that as we progress, humility is part and parcel of it. Let's try to embrace this notion of Freemasonry, the order, Freemasonry, education, philosophy, and spirituality. Today in our secular environment, it seems very awkward for us to deal with that issue. It's almost in some circles that we want to avoid that the complications that have occurred, and I guess they've always occurred, around the way religion and faith seems to have been defined by zealots. And we know that's far from accurate. It's a perspective, but and it's fueled by mass media and some of the conflicts that go on in the world. Of course, and that seems to have always been the nature of this type of discussion. All of that at arm's length. I think we are fundamentally an order. And that's why I'd like to encourage one and all to remember that. You don't need me pointing a finger out. You're already are aware. But the question is always, how does that determine how we react, how we respond, and how we treat one another? Simply talking in platitudes about a fellow ascribed to certain principles of the order does not define him. Saying that this is the Masonic way. Well, I think that's important to understand, but it's a standard that we have to live by, and we know that we exhibit that standard by our behavior, not the smugness, not the hubris, and above all, we need to be aware that we seem all prone to becoming overbearing. Now, that's a curious phenomena that I'm puzzled about, and I think I'd like your help with that one. The authority, whether I'm wondering if this includes not just military and religious and political, I wonder if it includes the authority of research and science, I'm wondering, but the tendency always is that it becomes overbearing. Now, we've seen, history again has taught us many, many examples of this. Why that happens it should puzzle us. We're seeing another embarrassing example of this in a major Canadian city where people that are given the task of protecting the law of the country have embarrassed us. They have embarrassed themselves. They are going to be brought before the courts in large numbers for violating the civil liberties of people. Civil liberties is at the heart of Freemasonry. This is the free part of the word. not to say that this is not a bumper sticker. If you're not for us, you know, you're against us. I mean, good grief. This is really addressing the issue and the complication. How do we deal with this propensity for authority to become overbearing? It's not an easy task. We learn from our mistakes. But I wanted to get into today, and for the hundreds of you who have been tuning in regularly, thank you so very much. I'm believing that the way that I'm presenting this material, it will evolve, of course, but I'm believing that there is an appetite out there. So I'm not going to talk more about this. I'll get right into the notion of symbolism. I want the intent here is when you look at any of the symbols that you have a context. It's not just literal. Well, I suppose there's some that will be trying to make literal translation of everything that that's said and read about symbols. But symbols are information. Symbols are messages. Symbols are thoughts conveyed one to another. So here today, I'm reading again from the work of The Mysteries of Freemasonry, 1866. Atlas, according to the fable, was an ingenious master of astronomy, a doctor who knew nature in general and gave information about it. Homer gives us Atlas as a very learned god who knew all the obligations, obliquitios, he says, obliquitios of the coasts and all the depths of the sea. Virgil ascribes to the informations of the great Atlas the knowledge men had acquired of the moon, the eclipses of the sun, and the whole order of nature. There are some, as a little aside, who believe that the expression of the great architect of the universe is nature. So the name Atlas signifies a support, atla, which means prop up, like, which gave occasion to the invention of the metamorphosis of the Doctor Atlas into a column or high mountain that props up the arch of the heavens. The Phoenicians in the voyages, they repeated every third year to Tarshish through the Red Sea, and carrying on the commerce of all the coasts of Africa, often saw the highest mountain of Mauritania, whose top is generally covered in snow and seems joined with the heavens. The name of Atlas, or column, given to that mountain, the Bible of Atlas to be applied to it. They said he was king of Mauritania, a great astrologer and geographer, who at last was by the gods changed into a high mountain, reaching from the earth to the heavens. Among the other fables, they talked about the Hyades and Pleiades. The Hyades took their name from the figure V, which they form in the forehead of the celestial bull, and the Pleiades, which are that small platoon of stars so remarkable near the foregoing, near the bull, are the most known and easily to be distinguished of all the constellations of the zodiac. They particularly were of use to regulate the informations given to the disciples of the priests by means of an atlas, that is, of a horos bearing a celestial sphere. Atlas, humanized, became the father of the Hyades and Pleiades. And Orion, there we go back to Orion, which rises immediately after them, easily passed in the imagination of the fabulists for a libertine who incessantly pursues them. This picture is nothing more than the ancient symbol of the rich commerce for which the Phoenicians made the preparations in winter. It was the commerce of Hesperia. So Let's leave that for today. We're going to come up to dealing in the next couple of weeks with Mercury, Hermes, Camillus. And then I'm going to skip ahead and start to talk to you about some specific symbols. This is context from a far and distant time that we hope will reveal to us all the inner meanings, things that speak to us. And the reason why, if we're looking for context, we again come into the order, and one would assume that the point is well known: self-improvement, not the bumper sticker, self-improvement, which means first understanding our nature. That seems to be a matter of embracing or understanding human desire and the lessons that we are taught about dealing with human desire, and how complicated lives can become if human desire is unchecked. So we go about, perhaps not as much as we should, on this notion of self-improvement. Now, for the literalist, I think self-improvement could be, bear with me in this, I think self-improvement could be wearing a suit, now getting a haircut, taking a, making yourself look proper. It could be associating with a group of defined gentlemen, in an atmosphere of polite conversation, where the coarseness and vulgarity of life is kept at the door, where this take it or leave it attitude is dismissed. That being able to be in that atmosphere could be seen, I think, as an element of self-improvement. And yet for others, self-improvement, and you could see where that would do nothing on a moral level. Is that man immoral? Not necessarily. But for others, it's a matter of inquiry, looking at their nature, and trying to determine the meaning of this task. For you to tell me what it means to you does not transfer completely. I think there's different history and different valence. The whole notion that our history, our examples of philosophy, tells us that, and we're reminded of this in some of the ritual work, that we are accountable for our behavior. Our behavior is history, the memories of that linger in our mind. Now this gets, I think, becomes a complication, because the recall, if we move forward based solely on memory and recall, then I think we have complications. I think, as Margaret Campbell has pointed out to us, that we're going to be selective about our use, Dr. Campbell, be selective about our use of history. In fact, we're going to distort it. And when we do that, we can't learn. People's tendency to embrace and appreciate what they want and what's consistent with their own thoughts already, their own egos, does nothing to challenge the status quo. It's really a matter of searching for the our nature, and that means looking at the components of character and personality and behavior that are not pleasant, the balance points of life. We cannot reach a state of maturity in a state of vulgar bliss. So even with science, it has helped us understand that the eyewitness, the memory of the experience, is fallible. four people standing in a group watching a motor vehicle accident and asked to recount it days later or even moments later. The people that do these types of, have these kinds of encounters with people know that there's inconsistency. Now, so, and there, eyewitness, I saw that. There's what I saw. All we could do is say, this is what I think I saw. Now, the literalist may just frag over this type of thinking. But there is this, it's what we want it to be in our own mind, what our mind is telling us about, our that what our perception is telling us, and what really happened. Now, together we may get some common understanding of truth, I guess. But if what I see is inconsistent with what is, then my recall of the experience may not be all that I need in order to progress, that we need in order to progress. So I can sit and dwell on my nature and what I recall of things that happened 20 years ago. Well, good grief. Anybody, any thoughtful person would not expect precision from another person. Tell me precisely what you had for breakfast 20 years ago. What did you have for breakfast 2 days ago? I know some of you have that gyrus well-developed in your brain where you remember names. Yes, there's a reason why not all of us can remember names, why some of us do. But bring it back to a very practical level. What we recall and what we think about ourselves is only part of it. It's only part of the picture that we need to understand. It's only part of the history. Our behavior also tells us. The reactions of people around us also tell us. Things about ourselves that may be embarrassing and may be hard for us to handle, hard for our fragile little egos to handle, but absolutely necessary. If we're going to grow, the literature seems to suggest to us that we have to be able to look at areas of our, for information that we haven't looked at before. What areas of your character, and my character, do we tend to shy away? We all want to be able to be successful. So, in this order, isn't it rather apparent? While we get stuffy and get overbearing with rank and in some ceremony, it's an illusion. It's an illusion. It's symbol. The ritual and our perspective to it. As a fellow was telling me yesterday, a young Mason was telling me yesterday, he finds that sitting in a lodge where he knows what's going to be said, he can predict at this time, does anybody have anything? He knows who's going to stand up and say nothing. And he knows who's going to stand up after that fellow and say nothing. That process he finds boring. Oh my. The things that we don't like to admit about ourselves are the areas where we will probably find reason for growth. It's a miracle that curiosity survives formal education. Keep on sowing your seed, for you never know which will grow. Perhaps it all will. Thanks again to Al. So our 15th, 16th century friend Montaigne reminds us in this really, really tight little book by Sarah Bakewell on his life, The Life of Montaigne, in one question and 20 attempts at an answer. The 12th area, how to live, he questions, guard your humanity. And remember, he's writing of the times, 1570s the Treaty of Saint-Germain displeased everybody. This was a time when there was serious and major conflict between Catholic and Protestant. Protestants, always wanting more, thought its terms did not go far enough. Remember the context. As it granted them limited freedom of worship. Catholics were in power at the time. Catholics thought it went too far. They were anxious that Protestants would take any concession as a sign of encouragement. They feared that Protestants would press for an all-out revolution against the legitimate Catholic monarch and start another war. They were right about another war, but wrong about who would be responsible. Tensions kept rising and reaching a peak during celebrations held in Paris in August of 1572 to mark a dynastic wedding between the Catholic Marguerite de Valois and the Protestant Henri de Navarre. The leaders of three major factions came to the ceremony in a grim mood. The moderate King Charles IX, the radical Protestant leader Admiral Gaspard de Coligny, and the extremist Catholic Duke de Guise. Each faction was haunted by fear of the others. Good times. Inflammatory preachers raised the emotional temperature further among ordinary Parisians, urging them to rise up to prevent the wedding and wipe out the heretic leaders while they had the chance. The marriage went ahead on the 18th of August, and 4 days of official festivities followed. No doubt many breathed a sigh of relief when they ended, but late on the final night, the 22nd of August, 1572, someone fired an arquebus at the Protestant leader, Coligny, as he walked back to his house from the Louvre Palace, not killing him outright, but breaking his arm. An arquebus was, you can picture it in your mind, it is. Seems to have a great big funnel type, short barrel, I think bronze, correct me out there, powder release. News of the incident spread around town, and the next morning streams of Huguenots came to see Coligny, vowing revenge. Remember the Huguenots and the connection between James Anderson and John, his friend? Okay, we'll get back to that. And, of course, that had a bearing on the First Constitution, the two writers, and de Saulier, remember? And his significance with connective and his influence, perhaps, in the connectiveness with Scottish Freemasonry. Back to the story. Many of them believed, as most historians still do, that the king himself was behind the assassination attempt, together with his mother, a famous name, Catherine de Medici, the idea being to nip any potential Protestant rebellion in the bud by removing its leader. If true, this was a miscalculation on Charles' part. The attack made the Protestants angry, but it made the Catholics fearful. Expecting Protestants to rise up in response to what had happened, they gathered around the city and prepared to defend themselves. The king was probably unnerved too, and may have reasoned that a dead rebel leader was less dangerous than a wounded one. Apparently, on his orders, a royal guard broke into Coligny's house and finished the botched job by killing the injured man in his bed. On the morning of the 24th of August, St. Bartholomew's Day, they cut off his head and dispatched it to the palace. It would be eventually embalmed and sent to Rome for the Pope to admire. Meanwhile, the rest of the body was thrown out the window, where a Catholic crowd set it on fire and dragged it into the district. The body fell to pieces as it smoldered, and it was mutilated and paraded around the town for days. Catholic gangs rushed onto the streets and seized and killed recognizable Protestants, set their bodies on fire and threw them in the river. when Charles had whatever Charles had intended by the original assassination, if indeed he was responsible, he can hardly have intended this. He now ordered his soldiers to suppress the violence, but it was too late. The killing went on for nearly a week through the districts of Paris, then spread around the rest of the country. In Paris alone, the massacres, which were known for evermore by the name of St. Bartholomew, left up to 5,000 dead. By the end, some 10,000 in France. Cities were sucked into the violence. Orléans, Lyon, Rouen, Toulouse, Bordeaux, and countless smaller towns. It was a furor of the kind Montaigne detested, even on a traditional battlefield. But here the victims were civilians. On the whole, so were the killers. Only in a few places were soldiers or officials involved. Bordeaux was one of these few. Nothing happened until the 3rd of October. But when it did, it was apparently organized and approved by the fanatical Catholic mayor of the time. We tend to find that zealots cause complications for all of us. In most places, the bloodshed was done more chaotically and by people who would have been reasonable folk the rest of the time. In Orléans, the mob stopped at taverns between killings to celebrate, accompanied by singing, lutes, and guitars, according to one historian. Some groups were composed mainly of women or children. Catholics interpreted the president of the latter as a sign that God himself was in favor of the massacres, for he had caused even innocents to take part. Once the Huguenots had collected themselves and gathered armies to fight back, all out war broke out again. It would continue through the 1570s with only occasional pauses. Besides ordinary battles, much misery was now caused by uncontrolled gangs of soldiers on the rampage, even during supposed peace interludes, when they had no masters and no pay. Peasants sometimes fled and lived wild in the forest, rather than wait in town to be attacked and sometimes tortured for the fun of it. This was the state of nature with a vengeance. The wars were fed by religious ardor, but the sufferings of war in turn generated further apocalyptic imaginings. Both Catholics and Protestants thought that events were approaching a point beyond which there could be no more normal history, for all that remained was the final confrontation between God and the devil. This is why Catholics celebrated the Saint Bartholomew's massacres so joyfully. They saw them as a genuine victory over evil, and as a way of driving countless misled individuals back to the true church before it was too late for them to save their souls. It all mattered a great deal because time was short. In the last days, the Christ would return. The world would be obliterated, and everyone would have to justify his or her actions to God. There could be no compromise in such a situation, no seeing the other person's point of view, and certainly no mutual understanding between rival faiths. Montaigne, with his praise of ordinary life and of mediocrity, was selling something that could have no market in a doomed world. Contemporary demonologist Jean Baudin argued that in crisis situations such as these, standards of evidence must be lowered. Witchcraft was so serious and so hard to detect using normal methods of proof that society could not afford to adhere too much to legal tidiness and normal procedures. Public rumor could be considered almost infallible. If everyone in a village said that a particular woman was a witch, that was sufficient to justify putting her to torture. There were armies indeed. Jean Riera, in his De Precis Demona of 1564, had calculated that at least 7,409,127 demons were working for Lucifer under the middle management of 79 demon princes. Alongside them were witches. A dramatic rise in witchcraft cases after the 1560s provided more proof that the apocalypse was coming. Public rumor could be considered almost infallible. Medieval techniques were revived specifically for such cases, including swimming suspects to see if they floated and searing them with red-hot irons. The number of convicted witches kept rising as standards of evidence went down, and the increase amounted to further proof that the crisis was real and that further adjustment of the law was necessary. As history has repeatedly suggested, nothing is more effective for demolishing traditional legal protections than the combined claims that a crime is uniquely dangerous and that those behind it have exceptional powers of resistance. My goodness. This almost takes your breath away. This is being repeated in our newspapers, even today. Maybe we should sit up and pay closer attention. It was all accepted with hardly a murmur, except by a few writers, such as Montaigne, who pointed out that torture was useless for getting at the truth, since people would say anything to stop the pain. And that besides, it was putting a very high price on one's conjectures to have somebody roasted alive on their account. A major development warned of by the theologians was the imminent arrival of the Antichrist. Signs would abound in coming years. In 1583, an old woman in an African country gave birth to an infant with cat's teeth who announced in an adult voice that it was the Messiah. Simultaneously, in Babylon, a mountain burst open to reveal a buried column on which was written in Hebrew, "The hour of my nativity is come." The leading French expert on such Antichrist tales was Montaigne's successor in the Bordeaux Parlement, Florimond de Raymond, also an enthusiastic witch burner. Raymond's work, L'Antichrist, analyzed portents in the sky, the withering of vegetation and harvest, population movements, the cases of atrocity and cannibalism in the wars, showing how all proved that the devil was on his way. As it turned out, regicide was unnecessary. The payback, kill the king. Charles IX died of natural causes a year and a half later on May 30th, 1574. And the throne passed to another of Catherine de' Medici's sons, Henry III, who proved even more unpopular. He was not even liked by many Catholics. Support grew throughout the 1570s for the Catholic extremists, known as Liguists, who would cause the monarchy at least to have as much trouble as the Huguenots in coming years under the leadership of the powerful and ambitious Duke de Guise. From now on, the wars in France would be a three-way affair, with the monarchy often caught in the weakest position. Henry tried occasionally to take over leadership of the leagues himself to neutralize their threat, but they rejected him and often portrayed him as a satanic agent in disguise. On the one hand, Henry filled his courts with fops and turned it into a realm of corruption, luxury, and absurd points of etiquette. He went out dancing every night and in youth wore robes and doublets of mulberry satin with coral bracelets and cloaks slashed to ribbons. He started a fashion for shirts with four sleeves, two for use and two trailing behind like wings. Some of his other affectations were considered even stranger. He used forks at table instead of knives and fingers. He wore night clothes to bed. He washed his hair from time to time. On the other hand, Henry also put on an exaggerated display of mysticism and penitence. The more perplexed he became by the problems facing the kingdom, the more frequently he took part in processions of flagellants, trudging them barefoot over cobble streets, chanting psalms and scourging himself. To Montaigne, the notion that the solution to the political crisis should lie in prayer and extreme spiritual exercise made no sense. He recoiled from the processions and put no credence in comets, freak hailstorms, monstrous births, or any of the other signs of doom. In general, he preferred to stick to his motto, "I suspend judgment." Most reports of witchcraft seem to Montaigne to be efforts of human imagination, not of satanic activity. Do you see the parallels? Do you see the parallels? Pick a history from that long ago. Perhaps it's a little safer for us to talk about these issues. No, not in terms of the divisions between Catholics and Protestants. My goodness, like, give it up. But there's lessons about the conflict. Imagine being so afraid of people of another faith that you thought that your mortal soul was in peril. Is there any grasp of how important it is to run from superstition? Popular opinion? Oh, think of the true danger that we're talking about if we all begin to believe in the absurdity. We become remarkably dangerous. Human nature, it's a puzzle. Now, in the back of my mind, what can we apply from these lessons to our lives, to our understanding? History doesn't necessarily start out to be kind. Thucydides tells us men naturally despise those who court them. Ah, the sycophants. Don't you just love them the best? Brown nosers, butt kissers, anything around. They melt around anybody with a semblance of authority or power. Men naturally despise those who court them, but respect those who do not give way to them. Men's indignation, it seems, is more excited by legal wrong than by violent wrong. The first looks like being cheated by an equal. The second, like being compelled by a superior. I wonder what he did. Did he just sit around thinking about these things? The secret to happiness is freedom. The secret to freedom is courage. Ha! The strong do what they have to do, and the weak accept what they have to accept. What's your calling, brethren? You've been called? You feel that the order is a calling? Now, I started to get excited reading about we've read a little bit about the history. This is going back to the history of the world in six classes. We talked about the development of coffee houses in Britain, in particularly London, and the difference of the coffee house in France. But we're talking about how discussion was occurring that was outlawed. We were in Britain, there was open discussion, open and frank discussion going on. In France, efforts were made by the authority to try and curtail discussion. anywhere where we hear an authority attempting to quash discussion, anywhere, we know it is doomed. Now here's the results of the efforts. And remember, it's taking us back to the discussions where the orators were on the chairs haranguing the audience, and whether if the audience liked it, they would applaud loudly. And here at the time, because of the circumstance in France at the time, speakers were beginning to talk about violence against the government. Oh, breathtaking. And they, of course, remember, this would never happen here. Are you on drugs? Leave everything as it is with some semblance of ignorance, and this is what happens. As the public mood darkened, a meeting of the assembly of notables, the clergy, aristocrats, and magistrates failed to sort out the financial crisis, prompting King Louis XVI to convene the States General, an elected national assembly for the first time in over 150 years. Maybe that would annoy people. Is that called proroguing? The meeting in Versailles degenerated into confusion, however, prompting the king to sack his finance minister, Jacques Necker, and call out the army. Always a solution when I find the conversation not going the way I want. Where is that army when you need them? Ultimately, it was the Café de Foix on the afternoon of July 12, 1789, that a young lawyer named Camille Desmoulins, let me say it as an Anglais from Prince Edward Island, Desmoulins, set the French Revolution in motion. Crowds had gathered at the nearby gardens of the Palais Royal, and tensions rose as the news of Necker's dismissal spread, since he was the only member of the government trusted by the people. Revolutionaries stoked fears that the army would soon descend to massacre the crowd. Desmoulins leaped onto a table outside the café, brandishing a pistol and shouting, "To arms, citizens, to arms!" His cry was taken up, and Paris swiftly descended into chaos. The Bastille was stormed by an angry mob 2 days later. The French historian Jules Michelet subsequently observed that those who assembled day after day at the Café de Procope saw with penetrating glance in the depths of their black drink the illumination of the year of the revolution. It literally began at a café. Today, I like to imagine, this is not simply saying that this is the context. I'm not saying that the start of the revolution was a simple affair. This had taken hundreds of years. But we see it capped. We see it reaching an unstoppable point. The ignorance that led up to this, the arrogance, the overbearing nature of the people with power. I don't know what to do. And you hear that people are saying they're part of the 99%. I'm just hoping, can we stop at this time? Do we have a chance to? Can we really? Is this the modern day versions of all of this stuff? I don't know. I hope not. But it's imperative that we listen. We can't stop somebody from standing on a chair outside of every... It's a coffee house. How are you going to stop the conversation? We can't. The concerns, the troubles, worries, we can at least... within our order, we can at least and should and always be thoughtful and reasonable and look at both sides. Take a page from the book of this 16th century phenomena, Montaigne. Reserve judgment. As he says, embrace mediocrity. Nothing mediocre about him. Today, the consumption of coffee and other caffeinated drinks is so widespread, both in and out of the home, that the impact of coffee's introduction and the appeal of the first coffee houses is difficult to imagine. It certainly is for all of us. Modern cafes pale by comparison with their illustrious historical forebears, yet some things have not changed. Coffee remains the drink over which people meet to discuss, develop, and exchange ideas and information. From neighborhood coffee clutches to academic conferences to business meetings, it is still the drink that facilitates exchange and cooperation without the loss of self-control associated with alcohol. The original coffee house culture is echoed perhaps best in internet cafes and wireless internet hotspots that facilitate the caffeine-fueled exchange of information, and in coffee shop chains that are used as ad hoc offices and meeting rooms by mobile workers. Is it any surprise that the current center of coffee culture, the city of Seattle, home to the Starbucks coffee house chain, is also where some of the world's largest software and internet firms are based? Coffee's association with innovation, reason, and networking, plus a dash of revolutionary fervor, has a long pedigree. Think about this one, gentlemen. This is an interesting one, brethren. On my next show, we'll talk about tea and the British Empire. Equally fascinating. But think about this, too. The coffee house, where we see the coffee house developed, where we see the little espresso shops, what we're seeing are the footprints of something happening, something that's been happening in those conversations, where the planners, the thinkers, the people that do have courage are attempting to move forward. By discussing their ideas, sharing their ideas. Let's hope that you and I have a sense of the right and wrongness because we have a sense of context. And it does not necessarily lead to simplistic answers, even though we may want them. What do we rely on? I think within the Order of Freemasonry, we rely on a sense of ethics. We should, I hope, always be making ethical decisions. Sorting out what's good and bad is the province of ethics. It is also what keeps priests, pundits, and parents busy. Unfortunately, what keeps children and philosophers busy is asking the priests, pundits, and parents, why? Dimitri says, I've been thinking about your question. What does good mean? And I've got it, the answer. Good is acting on a just principle. Teso, he says. By Zeus, Dimitri, you're full of surprises. You started to sound like a real philosopher. Just one last question. How do you determine just principles? Dimitri says, duh, just like everyone else. I learned them from my mom. Tesso, as an aside, why does Socrates get all the A students? He's a genius. Absolutist ethics, divine law, makes a simple business of ethics. If God says it's wrong, it is wrong, wholly and absolutely holy. That holy, W-H. That's all she wrote. But there are complications. The first is, how can we be sure that what God really thinks? Fundamentalists have that one covered. Scripture says so. But how did the people in Scripture know the signals they were getting were really from God? Abraham thought he was called by God to sacrifice his son on the altar. Abraham figures, if God says so, I better do it. Our first philosophical query to Abraham is, what are you, nuts? You hear God telling you to do a crazy thing and you don't even ask for identification? Another problem with following divine law is interpretation. What exactly qualifies in honoring thy father and thy mother? A Mother's Day card? Marrying the boring son of the family dentist? As thy honorable father and mother want you to do? These questions don't feel like Talmudic hair splitting when the dentist's son is 4'11 and weighs 270. a prime characteristic of divine law is that God always has the last word. Moses trudges down from Mount Sinai, tablets in hand, and announces to the assembled multitudes, "I've got good news for you, and I've got bad news." The good news is, I got them down to 10. The bad news is, adultery is still in. I know, there's just no reverence in the world like there should. I was raised by wolves. What can I tell you? In the meantime, I hope you found this program interesting. I hope you'll consider some of the ideas. I hope you'll have a robust and good and long weekend. Treat your friends very well. And I'm going to say goodbye to you today by letting you listen to Diana Krall as she extends the kind of wishes and sentiment that I never could on this 141st day of the year. I look forward to having you all back to join me in an upcoming show. And in the meantime, may the great architect of the universe guide you and be with you in everything that you do. See you soon.
Every time we say goodbye, I die a little. Every time we say goodbye, I wonder. Why the gods above me, who must be in the know, think so little of me, they allow. Goodbye.